Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Mark Lean is there. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Good to be with you again.
Good, you're good. And Mark, you were reading the very interesting interview in the Sunday Independent with the Minister for Arts, Culture, Sport and indeed the media, the cultural sector generally, Patrick O'Donovan. He's 48 years of age, a young man, three young children. And he spoke about epilepsy, and there's a reason for this that he brought it up. He said, epilepsy has limited my ability to do certain things that most people consider normal. It is a very debilitating condition that I have, to be quite honest. There was some surprise when Mr. O'Donovan was promoted to the cabinet in charge of arts and media. He said, I have a particular disability that prevents me from going into darkened rooms and prevents me from going into places with flashing lights. He has epilepsy. I have a photosensitivity that manifests itself into epilepsy, and I have to be very careful where I speak in public, the type of auditoria I go into and things like that. So when somebody who doesn't know me or doesn't know the sky over me and has never spoken to me makes a preconceived notion about me based on a disability, I don't think that's fair game. And what he was talking about was an article which basically said, why was Patrick O'Donovan made Minister for Culture? He doesn't go to the cinema, it seems, or he doesn't go or darken the door of a theatre. Can you contacted Liveline, I think, Mark, about 20 years ago about epilepsy and your story.
That's correct, Joe.
First of all, can you empathise with the Minister?
Absolutely, I can. He has photosensitive or provoked seizures, so the external reality can provoke a seizure in him. Mine is not quite like that, but I do have to switch off, we'll say, the likes of Wi-Fi and things like that before I go to bed every night, because okay, it actually affects me. It affects my sleep and stuff like that. Now, I don't suffer from epilepsy anymore, but I have had it down through the years in my life. And when I came on to you, I think it was back around 2000, between 2005 and 2010, something along those lines, I had bought a big lorry for touring as Emerald Elvis around Europe, and I was up the walls with gigs. I was doing 200 shows a year, and we had so much gear, it all needs to go into a big truck with a tail lift and everything, and living quarters, and I did it all up. And then finding that, hold on a second, I need, they're refusing me a Category C license to drive a lorry because it said, do you now or have you in the past suffered from any of the following when I went for the license application. Okay. And on that list was epilepsy. And then they said, sorry, we can't give you a license. And then I picked up the phone. I talked to Joe. That was the only thing that I could do at the time. I felt I wasn't being listened to. And thanks be to God, you changed everything. It changed my life.
You changed it because you were so powerful. It was on the first, I tell you, it's almost exactly 15 years ago, Mark, you contacted us. And this is an extract from what you said in June 2010.
I tell you, Joe, I feel I'm getting the runaround here. I bought a fantastic truck to tour around Europe, and unfortunately, I can't drive it. I had epilepsy when I was a young boy, what they call petit mal, the lighter form of epilepsy, and I found in my teenage years that if I drank alcohol at all, that it would develop into, like, seizures and attacks. So I completely stopped drinking alcohol at 21. And, you know, I was taken off my medication 3 years later because there was no epilepsy when there was no alcohol. So we'll say at the age of 24, I would have been taken off the medication.
Right.
And you know, 26, 27 up along, I would have been driving a car, et cetera, et cetera. And then I bought this fantastic truck to tour Europe, and I went into the Kerry County Council offices to apply for my C licence. And there was this, what I would term as a loaded question. Do you know or have you ever in the past suffered from any of the following? And down along the list, there was epilepsy, and I don't want to be telling lies, so I said yes to epilepsy in the past I did. And the unfortunate thing is, the girl told me that you can never have a C license in this country if you have suffered from epilepsy in the past, because they see some sort of a risk there. Now, this is completely at odds with England, the UK, Northern Ireland, and even in the rest of Europe. So I felt that, you know, I was being a victim in it. I felt that there was certainly going to be other people out there who had epilepsy maybe in their younger years and who now wish to drive maybe heavier vehicles or something like that and would come up against this. So I felt I'd take it further. I wrote to the minister. He indeed wrote back to me. He wrote to my GP. My GP was of the opinion that I could have even said no, because I don't suffer as such from epilepsy. It just hasn't been a part of my life, Joe.
Okay.
But still, I'm paying the price for it. And so we have this beautiful truck parked up for the last 2 years, and I can't drive it unless I pay somebody to actually drive the truck around Europe, you know.
And what happened after that, that day 15 years ago, Mark? You were brilliant, by the way.
Well,
you were brilliant.
Like Red Hurley says to me one time, you're some gobbin, you.
Okay.
He could talk, that young fella. In fairness, Joe, I mean, it was transformational. What your wonderful producers did is that they got to the people who make the laws in Ireland and they said, listen, Irish law is not in tandem and in step with European law. And the minister at the time sent in a letter and said, tell Mark Lean to reapply again in 3 months' time. At that stage, we'll have the legislation gone through. And I did, and I passed it, and I was the first former epileptic in Ireland to get a Category C truck licence. And when I got the certificate that day, the press was outside the office in Tralee, and they took photographs of me. It was on the front page of the paper. Since then, that was back in, 2010, you say. So I retired from my Elvis act in 2013. I did my last concert with the Concert Orchestra in Dublin, and so I sold the truck then after that, and lo and behold, my seizures came back in 2015. I was inside in the place one day, and I hadn't had a seizure for 20 odd years, but it came back, and there was like, I was drinking strong coffee, I had the phone up to my head, there was Wi-Fi box right next to me, and I think it created a perfect storm, and I got a seizure and literally went unconscious.
But when you applied for your C license for your Elvis truck, how long had you been free of epilepsy at that stage?
About 24 years old, so that would have been 1995. I was definitely over 10 years old, any or 10 years off. So 15 years since a seizure, so 2010, 95 would have been my last seizure.
And normally, I don't know, I think it still does apply. If you apply for a car license, they say to you, have you been free from seizures for a year, is it? I think it's for a car license.
The last I heard it was 3 years, Joe.
Okay, I'm just we'll but in other words, you had been free 15 years and you managed
to get
the law brought into line with the rest of Europe. And
hold on a second. Oh, your producers will have to take some of the credit for that, because
course,
we brought it to the public's attention.
Well done. Here.
But there's 50,000 people, Joe, in Ireland suffering from epilepsy, so there's got to be a straggling in there, you know. And I know you speak
and
to a multitude of audiences.
What the minister said about going into cinemas and having to be really careful because he'd be making speeches left, right, and centre. You know it, I know it, not as much as you do. You can go onto a stage and you cannot see the audience with the lights that are shining into your face. I mean, that would prompt, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I do a lot of theatre shows and I've done a lot of them. And I remember one stage we used to do a part in Suspicious Minds where strobe lights would come on. You'd see Elvis on the stage and the strobe lights going on. I'd have to clench my eyes shut inside the Cork Opera House up on the stage, still doing the moves, but make sure my eyes were clenched shut so I wasn't getting the effect of the strobe light. But I can imagine the minister going to see, we'll say, the likes of Katie Taylor fighting in Croke Park or whatever. And of course, it's a big occasion. He could, our minister there could be triggered for a seizure in the midst of this.
Yeah,
or go
to a play where there's
in a darkened room. It's the extent of the darkness to the bright.
I was at a play recently, I think, and there's a big sign in the foyer saying strobe lighting is in use in this play. So you have to be extraordinarily careful. And Mark,
you do.
When you have an attack, I know it's a long time since you had one. But when you have an attack, do you know what's happening to you? What do you feel?
Nothing. Like I was standing, like I said, with the phone up to my ear, with a cup of coffee in my hand, and I literally went unconscious standing up. And I woke up in an ambulance with doctors saying to my wife, don't show him a mirror, whatever you do. My nose was over at the other side of my face. My teeth were broken. I had what they call raccoon eyes, which is the slots in your eyes fill up with blood. And my face was completely swollen. I'd gone 10 rounds with Mike Tyson. And so you wake up to it. You don't feel it while you're in it. But there's always a danger that your airwaves could be blocked. And so a lot of people have died in the midst of epileptic seizures. And there's only 7 epileptologists, if you like, in the country.
Oh, is there?
You know, treating 50,000 people. And a very funny one, Joe, I must say this without mentioning names, because it's just, you know, some people believe and some people don't. I was coming out of Mass one Sunday in Tralee, and there was 4 women came over. Mark, how are you doing? We're still praying for you. We hope you're not getting seizures anymore. And I said, I'm not. And I said, look, if I could only get to see this doctor, Dr. Such and Such, you see, in Cork, he's one of only 7 epileptologists in the country. And there's a waiting list of 18 months to see him. And this woman piped up from one of the 4 ladies that was there. She said, he'll be seeing you before the week is out. And I said, what are you talking about? She says, he's married to my daughter. And if he wants me to be minding his children, she said, he'll see you. The following Tuesday, I was up there inside the scanner getting the MRI. And then he said, lovely man. And he down in Cork. And he said, Mark, he says, we think we've got it. Yours is hereditary. Someone back in your line had it. Okay. And we're going to give you this tablet twice a day. And I haven't had a seizure since. So, you know, one thing leading to another, like
that's,
you and the show and
very
the
Irish, very Irish, very Irish.
One isn't it lovely, though?
What did you say? He's married to my daughter.
She says, I said, if I could only see this guy. Yeah. I said, there's an 18-month list. I said, and you can understand that with 7 neurologists in the country specializing in epilepsy. And we've all got to see one of them. And there's ones in the Beaumont and in Dublin and stuff. But my fellow was in Cork. And he's a brilliant man, a wonderful man. And she said, he'll be seeing you before next week. And I looked at her and I thought she was out of her mind. And she said, I said, how do you know that? And she said, because he's married to my daughter. And if he wants me to be minding his children, he'll see you. And the next thing, I got a phone call 2 days later, Mark, come up and see me. And I was delighted. And we've become great friends today.
And he cured it, by the way. Another one. I know people would say, but it's another wonderful aspect of this great country. That little story. I know none of us agree with the 2-tier health system. But anyway, that story is. Are you still doing Elvis?
Yes, sir, I am. And there was a time when I was working on Funny Friday, and I used to come out all the time and say, when no one else can understand you, when everything you do is wrong, talk to Joe for consolation every day on RT1, and he's always there to lend a hand in everything you do. That's the wonder, Joe Duffy, the wonder of you.
Don't cry for me, Marcolina. Don't cry for me, Marcolina. The truth is, I'll never leave you.
And tell me, Mary, when did this head shop open up next door to you?
Stop.
My favourite Joe Duffy line is, you must have thought that I came down in the Liffey inside in a donut.
Donut, yeah. With sugar on it. Okay, Mark, will you mind yourself? That's
God bless you too, Joe. And listen, to remind Joe, us thank of, you for everything.
Indeed, and the team, and the teams. We were just going through a few of us this morning, all the people we worked with over the years. It's a telephone directory. But and thanks for highlighting the issue of epilepsy again. I didn't know there was 50,000. I didn't know there was that many. The minister himself talked about he had a seizure in the Dáil chamber. And that's when it forced.
Joe, can I say one thing before
yes,
I go?
Yes.
I think I know Liveline will carry on, but
course,
I think that Liveline without Joe Duffy will be like Vegas without Elvis, be like the Vatican without the Holy Father, the Late Late without Gabo, Dublin without Bewleys, country music without Daniel O'Donnell, and Kerry football without Mick O'Connor. God bless you, Joe.
God bless you.
I look forward to the next thing that you do, Joe.
Yeah, okay. And the next thing is
God bless you.
Tomorrow's programme. Go to meet him all. Good, Mark Lean. Joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I was told yesterday, and I'm still trying to verify it, we had 3 stories on Liveline last week of 3 women, as it happened, in their over 70, being assaulted on the streets of Dublin, being assaulted, over 70. The 3 of them obviously hit the ground and were in shock. But I was told yesterday, if you assault in Italy, if you assault somebody over 70, it's considered and you would be charged with, and the police would treat it with, the seriousness of attempted murder. If you assault somebody over 70, obviously they're in, none of us are getting any younger, and you heard the various stories, the shock, the bruises the next morning, the effect that, and any of us know, thankfully it didn't happen, any of our three callers last week, but you know, if an older person has a fall, and ends up in hospital, it's the beginning of a sequence of hospitalizations, unfortunately. But anyway, that was the piece of information I discovered yesterday. Now, this brings me back to e-scooters, because three of one of the people that was assaulted was on an e-scooter. Teresa is in Kerry. Teresa, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
Good. What happened to you? You're in Tralee.
Oh, well, I wasn't assaulted, no, but
I know that.
I was driving down the town, and I was just watching the traffic in my rear mirrors as well as the front, and I could see an e-scooter coming with two young lads on it, and they were very young. One seemed to be around 12, 14 years of age. And they were whizzing in and out between the traffic, and from the footpath in and out completely between the traffic. I could see them coming up behind me, so the traffic was kind of just going very slowly at the time. And I could see the danger, because obviously they don't wear helmets.
Yeah,
and
of course,
they seem to be very young, and the two on it. And then the traffic got a little bit quicker. So I pulled in further down the street, and I rang the guards. And apparently the guards got quite a few calls on it and dealt with the situation in the next few days and got back to me.
Okay.
But I think the whole situation, I mean, I have a son in Cork and a son in Nice. And my daughter used to live in Dublin. She's back down out to Tralee, thank God. But visiting those cities and seeing the amount of e-scooters on the road and on the street, flying between people walking and in and out between cars is frightening. And in my opinion, I think all e-scooters should have number plates. They should be over 18. They should be paying tax. They should wear helmets. And they should be responsible for all the damage that they do cause.
Well, that means insurance.
Of course. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it's movable, and also anything that moves that fast on the road, it should be paying insurance, and it should be responsible for what they're doing.
Okay,
it's frightening, Joe.
And the laws have changed, but it doesn't seem to have made much of a difference. The laws changed fairly significantly. Stay there, Teresa. Joe at rt.ie, 51551, text 0818715815. Daniel is in Waterford. What happened, Daniel? You there, Daniel? Come in, Daniel. Daniel is in Waterford. He's not on the knee scooter. By the way, did the guardy, Teresa, did they catch the
They
culprit?
Did. They dealt with the situation.
Okay.
They did, yeah. They were underage, and the guards got back to me within a few days, and they had dealt with it. And they said that they were keeping an eye on anyone underage that time driving e-scooters.
Okay.
The situation actually is kind of under control by the guards, and which is very good.
Okay, that's in. What do you mean the guards are vigilant?
Well, they are, yeah.
They're reacting to what people are saying. Okay.
Oh, God, definitely. But I was in Portugal there recently on holidays, and it's frightening, the amount that's on e-scooters. They're on the marinas, they're going in and out between people. They're, you know, I can understand why people need e-scooters, Joe, because a lot of people maybe in cities, especially in cities, it's an easy way to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe they can't afford a second car, or maybe, you know, with parking, etc. It's difficult, and I can understand why people need them. But I actually think they should be over 18.
Okay, just the rules that came in, actually the beginning of this year, they've been a long time talked about. Do I need license or insurance to ride an e-scooter? No. What's the speed limit for e-scooters? 20 kilometres on public roads. On public roads, remember, not footpaths. What's the minimum age? 16. Can I ride my e-scooter on footpaths or motorways? No. Off limits, cycle lanes, bus lanes, local, regional, national roads. Do I wear a helmet? They're not legally required, but recommended.
No.
Can I carry a passenger? No, you cannot carry a passenger. Can
they're
I have
up,
a seat?
They're up on them on twos.
Can I have? I know that. Can I have a seat or a saddle? No. It must have a maximum output of 400 watts rated power, not peak power. a maximum weight of 24 kilos, including the batteries. A must have, this would be a new one, I've seen lights, a bell. Did you know they had to have a bell or an audible warning device, reflectors and brakes?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes.
There's a few regulations, but they're not enough. Is Daniel there? Daniel, are you with me now?
Can you hear me, Joe?
Yeah, it's loud and clear. What happened to you, Daniel?
Friday the 13th of June,
okay.
7 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. in the afternoon.
Right.
Or the evening. I was walking towards the city centre here in Waterford from Johnstown into John Street. And I just stopped to have a look in the window.
Okay.
Turned to my left, and a young guy, probably 16, 17, came along on one of those e-scooters.
Right.
And he blew me off the footpath. He didn't stop. He just put his finger up at me. He done serious damage to my left wrist, to my nose, broke my glasses. I went to the guards and made a statement. But I'm still suffering at the minute because I had a bad accident 2 years ago. I fractured my pelvis in two places.
Wow.
And I'm still a bit shocked by it. All that being said,
yeah,
I drive a car. I have to have an NCT. I have to have tax. I have to have insurance.
Yeah.
But more importantly than that, I have to have a car registration number. To whereby, if I do anything illegal in my car, because of my reg, I can be tracked.
Mm.
That has to happen. Because I have interviewed elderly people, somewhat of the same age as myself, men, women, and young ladies with prams. They're now in a state of fear to go on the footpath because of these e-scooters. Now, you can't ride an e-scooter in a pedestrian area. That's the law. In Grattan Square, in Waterford City, any given day of the week, you will see e-scooters going around everywhere. And they don't care about people or damaging or hurting people.
We switched off for a minute. This is switched off. Put on the TV.
Yeah, OK, the trees are still there. And Daniel, was anyone caught?
No. No. Not to this point in time.
You went to the Gardaí.
Yep. Made a statement. They said they'll have to look at the CCTV camera and ask me, would I then be prepared to go to court? To which I said, yeah, I would. Will it do any good? I don't know. But just as you read to your previous listener there, you read out all the legislation. I read it myself last week. And none of it, I know the lady in Tralee maintains, said that the Garda are actively dealing with these situations. However, I'm out every day of the week driving. And every day of the week, not once, not twice, not three or four, 20 times a day I'm seeing these e-scooters on bikes with one, two and three people on them. As you indicated, they have no bells on the bikes. They give no alarm on the bike. And by law, they are not supposed to be on the footpaths. That's the law.
I know. You try and stop them.
Well,
we heard yesterday and today.
You, Joe, if I had to turn 2 seconds earlier, I wouldn't be speaking to you from my home now. I'd be speaking to you from a hospital bed. That's how serious this has gone.
Yeah.
And like, if I drove up a one-way street in a car.
Oh, I know. Well, the car is. You know, the argument is the car is much bigger, much more lethal. Though e-scooters have killed people, not in this country, but they have, apart from, unfortunately and tragically, some users. But they have, people have been killed in the UK.
Would I not be correct in saying that there was an e-scooter robbed from one of the hospital premises in Dublin last year? Hit a pedestrian?
Yeah.
Somewhere around.
Okay, no, I wasn't aware of that. But I know tragically young people have been killed off their own e-scooters. Tragically.
But during the tsunami of all of this is, and I have spoken to people at their doors in my work capacity, and they are afraid to go on the footpath. They're afraid to walk. And that's the realisation of all of this. People are afraid. And I don't blame them. Because I'm 66 and I'm strong enough, but I'm still in a state of shock over what happened to me last Friday night week, you know?
Okay. Where's John? John, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe. How are you?
E-scooters. Okay, it's, all of this is self-evident, but how are you going to implement it? I do not know. What do you think? What do you think should happen?
Well, 2 years ago, I was knocked down on a one-way street. I came out from behind the back of a bus, and I didn't bother looking to my left. Why would I? It was a one-way street. And I can almost say, like, what happened next? I thought, Joe, I was after being hit by an Arctic truck. Such was the force of the way the scooter hit me and blew me down to the ground. I just got my hand up and I saved my head. If my head, is, at the force she hit me, if my head, only for just protecting it and my kind of good reflexes, my head hit the road, we wouldn't be having this conversation now like your other caller there, right? And such is the extent of that, that I never took my safety for granted in my beloved Cork City, right? But every time I go in, I'm a bit unnerved all the time. I now suffer from post-traumatic stress. More, as safe. Much as I would say that if I was hit by one again, I don't think I'd survive at the fight.
Okay, so okay, and you say they have to be licensed, so we have to set up a licensing body. That's bureaucracy. They have to be insured, so that would deter a lot of them from...
And nobody under 17 should be on them.
But on the other hand,
now
just one argument I heard recently, and we weren't talking about 17-year-olds, we were talking about social carers and home helps who were under pressure, as you know, and badly paid, and they have to go from A to B to C and back to A 3 or 4 times a day, and they're finding these scooters absolutely brilliant.
That's grand, Joe, because they're all adults, right? But I mean, there's no 15-year-old involved in home help or 16 or 17-year-old. And they're all over the footpaths here in Cork, right? I mean, between them now and the guys delivering the fast food and the bikes and the electric bikes, I mean, it's like a bloody war zone. And I am terrified. I don't think if I was hit again, I'd survive it. I got such a fright that day. I know I've post-traumatic stress and probably will have it for the rest of my life.
Good God. Gardaí? Yeah.
Gardaí confiscated the scooter on the day, even though the guard said, I don't know, am I doing the right thing? He said, well, the law is at this state, but he said, I'm confiscating it anyway, right? Mm-hmm. But this is what should happen. Anyone under 17, the minute the guard see them, that should be the law. I mean, you should be confiscated straight away. And anyone over 17 then should have to have a license. It should be numbered, licensed, and insurance, and wear a helmet. And no cycling on the footpath, use the cycle lanes.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to think of the other side, because a lot of cyclists don't believe in wearing cycle helmets. They don't. They for their own good reasons. I just wonder if you wear a very strong helmet on an e-scooter, if that fella had hit you with the helmet on, it would have done more damage to you, John.
Well,
I'm just trying to think outside the box.
The thing is with the bike, if you're on a bike and you fall off of the bike or you hit someone, but if you fall off yourself, you're falling from a lower centre of gravity. But if you're standing up on an e-scooter and you fall off, not only the person like me that you would injure, but yourself standing at such a, falling at such a vertical height, you're going to do serious damage to yourself.
Sheila in Kilkenny.
Yes, Joe, I just want to tell you, I'm home. I was absolutely terrified. I was walking on a path, a very narrow path.
Okay.
There was a wall on one side of me and railings on another side.
Okay.
And I was going down a hill. Now, two people really cannot pass. You have to kind of go sideways.
Sheila, this was today.
Yes.
Today,
I'm just what has motivated me. When I came in, I heard what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never ring the radio, except that I find that there was no path where I was on that particular road, bridge. And she flew on a scooter. And I heard her saying, sorry, but she was gone like a bullet. A youngish girl, I'd say she was probably in her teens. And I was terrified. I nearly fell into her. No, it was just terrifying. That's all I can say. And why they don't go on the road, I cannot understand. There's no bell ringing to warn me. My hearing is impaired and I don't hear perfectly. But even if a bell went, you'd be aware of it, and I would. All I could do would be stand right into the wall. I couldn't get out because of the railings on the other side onto the road. So I just want to add my name and say that I don't know, maybe they should be taught in school how terrifying it is for old people.
But when you said, Sheila, when you said she said sorry, but you didn't think she meant it.
Oh, she was flying. She was gone past me. And I, of course she didn't mean it. She shouldn't have been there in the first place. If she really meant sorry, she wouldn't go on a footpath where there was nowhere for me to go on the right-hand side because I had the railings, and on my left-hand side it was a wall. So I was totally hemmed in on that footpath.
And if any, it's hard to know, any idea what speed they were doing?
I wouldn't have the remotest idea. All I know is it was going down a hill.
Oh,
and she was absolutely flying. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that people of Kilkenny beware, and I'm sure they are all aware of these scooters that are flying. And no bells. It should be compulsory that they have a bell and be told, you know, to use the bell. It would be some help anyway.
Okay. Sheila, mind yourself. How are you now? Are you okay?
Yeah. Well, I'm just, I'm still very uptight, but thank God I was very lucky. Yeah, yeah.
And, are you,
and thank you, Joe.
Sheila, are you a daily mask goer?
Well, a lot of the time I am, and I say to the Lord, the Lord who protected me, and I'm sure of that. Yeah,
Do you go to the one church every day?
I do. Okay. I go. It's a 5:01 mass that I go to.
Lovely.
And it's lovely. Yeah.
Okay,
Joe.
God bless you,
and
Sheila.
Thank you so much, and God bless you for bringing all these things to everybody's notice.
Okay, and God bless you, Sheila, and all the listeners. Thanks indeed, that's Sheila Kilkenny. Martin, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Joe?
E-bikes
and electric scooters, Joe, go into Dublin City any evening.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of them have no helmets, no high vis and no lights.
Right.
And how the bloody hell they think an ordinary motorist, especially in the likes of a rainy evening, can see these people.
Yeah.
Now, I'm originally from Rathfarnham, and when I was growing up in Rathfarnham, if the guards caught us without a light on our bike was taken off us.
That,
we had to go to the station with one of our parents.
It was a charge.
To
driving.
Retrieve our bike and have lights to fit on it.
Okay, yeah.
Now, I cycle and I drive, and a provisional licensed driver driving a motorbike by law has to wear a high vis with a nail on it.
Okay, that's true, yeah. The tabard, yeah.
So what makes these people think they can drive around without any form of lights, identification?
Because they say the power in them isn't anything like a motorbike.
Well,
the weight in them isn't anything like a motorbike.
My bike is an assist bike, and it is very heavy. But I expect people to be able to see me. If I'm only going as far as the library, which is only a mile down the road, I have my helmet and my high vis on me. Because in rain or in bad light, you can't see these people. Most of them are dressed in black.
Yeah.
I only come in along this morning and three of them passed me on an e-bike.
Yeah, but the thing I'm thinking about...
With hoodies up and...
But they must know. They must know.
Oh, they do know.
No, hang on. They must know that in a tussle between an e-bike and a car, the car is going to win.
Yeah. And who's going to pay the damage? The person driving the car.
Yeah, but I know. I'm just saying in terms of safety. They must know It's ridiculous that they won't put on a high vis.
And
you can get a high vis. You shove it in your jacket pocket when you get off, and you're going into a.
Oh, and you see people cycling along with the helmet hanging off the handlebar.
Yeah. Okay. A lot of people angry about it. I maybe we need a week of e-scooter education and visibility. And law enforcement.
I came on a roadblock actually coming out of town one evening, just slightly after COVID. The guards were stopping there after 10 euro.
Okay.
And I said to the guard, I said, there's two bikes coming on behind me with no lights, all dressed in black. I said, you can barely see them. And he says, there's nothing I can do.
Okay. Well,
they can flaunt the law all they want.
Well, let it be heard. Let
until
this be heard.
It's changed.
Okay, Martin.
And implemented.
Martin, safe travelling. Well done. Good meal, Margaret. Martin. Joe at rt.ie 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
It was a tragic story last week in the UK, and it rightly so garnered a lot of front pages. And that was a woman. She happened to be a grandmother. She's a very young woman. And she was on holidays in Morocco, was bitten by a dog and unfortunately died of rabies. Now, there is a remarkable story here in Ireland, and we'll get Brian Maher and Alison Maloney to tell us about their family going back and the connection with rabies and indeed Louis Pasteur. Brian Maher, good afternoon.
How's it going, Joe?
Good. Can you tell us about your relative and the connection?
I can, of course. So it was my grandfather.
Okay.
So the best I can do is tell you the story that was handed down to me. So the story goes, he was 3 years of age. He was only a toddler. And he was playing underneath the kitchen table as his mother was preparing vegetables.
Okay.
And there was a dog. I'm not clear as to whether the dog was our dog or just a dog that was rambling around. That bit I'm not clear on.
Right.
And like all children, I think he threw a bit of a... the story goes he threw a bit of a turnip at the dog and the dog bit him.
Okay.
Now, at that time, there was something going on in Ireland. It was a kind of like COVID in the sense that rabies was becoming a thing and you had to report any bites. They were obviously trying to get on top of it at the time.
And
so,
do you know what year we're talking about?
I'm sorry?
Do you know what year we're talking about when this...
Oh, 1891.
Oh, okay, 1891, okay.
1891. He, my grandfather was 3 at the time. He died in 1980 at the age of 92.
Wow.
So, anyway, the dog went on down the road and a day later bit two more people in Kilkenny City, about 10 miles in the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dog was shot, buried, and then... after the question about the rabies, the dog was exhumed and tested, I guess, and the diagnosis was rabies.
Oh my God.
At the time, I suppose, money was scarce. So a local landowner called Lord Bellew, who lived in Jenkinstown House down the road, he put up the money. I think it was £20 back then, which is about €4,000 today. He put up the money to send the 4 people that were bitten across to Paris to be treated by Louis Pasteur. He had found a cure, I think, about 5 years previous to this. So 8 days later, they were in Paris being treated, and they were treated for 16 days.
Yeah.
The treatment was anybody that had wounds, they were cauterized with gunpowder. The treatment for the actual rabies itself was an injection of bone marrow into the stomach. So after 16 days of this, on the way home, one of the patients unfortunately died on the way home, a young child. One guy died, I think, 2 months later, and the other two lived long and healthy lives.
Okay, and say that, Brian. It's fascinating. Alison Maloney, again, you're a grandniece of Nettie. You've done an awful lot of research on this. Tell us what you discovered. It was your granduncle.
He was my granduncle, Joe, and thank you so much for having us on.
Oh, yeah.
In 1990s, we didn't really know many details, so we wrote to the Institute of Pasteur in Paris, and we just inquired... did they have any records that, you know, we knew that our granduncle had gone there. But, like, this was over 100 years later.
I can't say that,
We just weren't sure. So we actually got a neighbour to write the letter in French to them so that it would be very clear what we were looking for.
Okay.
And lo and behold, a few weeks later, we got a letter back in French enclosing all the records of Neddy's treatment, his attendance, the dates he attended, and also the dates of the names of the other three, two children, one age six, one age eight, and a man aged 55, and gave us all the details. And when we received those, we translated them again. We went to our neighbour again. She translated all the records. Obviously, we shared them with our family and Brian's family, and also tried to contact the families of the other people, who went to the institute in Paris. So it was amazing. It was an amazing story. So, you know.
And the letter said, and again, remember, this is over 100 years later, the Pasteur Institute in Rue de Docteur Rue in Paris, arrondissement 15. They and you translated the letter. They say Thomas Marr survived, and then they named the three other children. Dennis Hickey, George Beale, which was also spelled Bale, B-E-A-L-E, and an infant Mulroney.
Yeah, Marie Mulroney. And actually, Dennis was an adult. So on the 13th of November, on the 13th of November, there were two people bitten. That was my granduncle Neddy and Dennis Hickey. And then on the following day, the dog ran into town, and on the way into town, bit Marie Mulroney. It was only a young girl, small girl. And also George Beale, who was just on the doorstep of his house and came out to pat the dog. And, you know, poor George subsequently passed away 2 months later. Like, he didn't survive it.
So are you saying there was four children that were bitten?
Yeah. Well, there was four people bitten in total.
Yeah.
One adult and three children. The eldest child was 11. The eldest child was 8. The next was 6. Uncle Neddy was 3. And Dennis Hickey was, I think, maybe 55.
Yeah, Monsieur Dennis Hickey, they call him. Now, who came up with the idea? Like, well, again, it's 1891. There's newspapers, but there's no other form, apart from word of mouth, of letters, communication. Who came up with the idea of trying to get the children across to Paris?
Well, my own opinion on that, and Brian may need to add something on that as well, is that there was a fear of rabies in the country, and we had a lot of English lords, and a lot of people were well-travelled. Lord Bellew was probably well-travelled, and there was a fear of rabies, and there was no cure for rabies in Ireland. It was a most dreadful death. Like, you get hydrophobia, which is fear of water. You can't even swallow your own saliva. But Uncle Neddy had an aunt who was a nun in a convent in Paris, and she put them up. I doubt there was any communication about that in a week's time. But the amazing thing about it is that they got to Paris, and within 8 days,
amazing.
They started their treatment.
And how many survived? Two or one?
Two.
Only two survived. Uncle Neddy and Dennis live long and very
Dennis
healthy
50,
lives.
The last, apparently, the last notified case of rabies in Ireland is 1903. And the last case, maybe we can get him, is Monaghan McGann, if you're listening, Monaghan. Monaghan McGann, one of his great books. He was travelling through, was to the Congo and there, and Monaghan thought he got bitten by a dog. Obviously, Monaghan's a young man, which he thought had rabies. Everyone around him thought had rabies. And he tells in his book this race against time to get to a medical centre in a different country that could treat rabies. The heart would be crossways in your mouth just reading it. But you also got the medical file from the pastor, his age.
Oh, it was amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Have you got it in front of you there?
I have bits and pieces,
Read out bits of it there, the number and location of the bites and examine.
I don't exactly have it now right in front of me, Joe, but so it just really translates in translate into Edward, his age, what his father's occupation was,
yeah.
The date of the bite, how many bites. Uncle Neddy had a few bites on his, about 8 bites in total on his hands and on his wrist.
Two not very deep, two not very wide, two fairly deep, having bled much, scabs fairly strong. His clothing was torn on his right wrist, his dorsal side bare, two puncture bites. My God, the dog's savage. I'm not very wide, but fairly deep, having bled a good deal, fairly strong scabs. Two other bites. How many bites did that poor child have?
Yeah, there was a few on the wrist. I think in total to about 8, between scratches and bites on the hand.
And the vet, again, this is from the...
The record,
not cauterised. Veterinary information, John Harry, the vet in Conaghy, declares that the dog had rabies. The dog was killed 2 days later. And did it bite other people or animals? Yes, two other people. And then there's the file numbers given. Uh-huh. It's incredible detail.
Yeah. It's incredible detail. Yeah, it was incredible detail. And it was something that my granduncle never forgot. It had a huge impact on him, even at such a young age. His father, James, travelled with them. Mm-hmm. At 40 years of age, this man probably had rarely been outside his parish county, let alone travel all the way through Ireland, across the sea, through England, maybe across to Dover, get another boat, maybe over to Calais, through Paris, with children who were bandaged, an adult who was bandaged, obviously injured people. And so you can imagine it was very traumatic for all of them.
Mm-hmm. Good God. And it's just, well, you've documented it brilliantly and well done. Who had the idea of writing to the Pasteur Institute 100 years later?
Well, I have to give the credit to my mother, who she would have been a niece of Neddy's. And my father, who put the letter together, and obviously our neighbour who put it into French. But I suppose we have a huge interest in history in our family. And, you know, there's an old saying, if you want to be remembered in posterity, don't forget to look backwards.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Well done. And again, it's just like this happened last week. We have an ad warning from warning people about rabies. Let's play it from the 1970s here in Ireland.
Rabies kills agonizingly. How do we prevent it reaching Ireland? When going abroad, leave family pets with friends. Alert customs if you suspect an animal is being smuggled in or coming ashore illegally. Vigilance can keep rabies out of Ireland.
Incredible. That was, well, again, people are travelling to more exotic, far-flung places these days with cheaper airlines, thankfully cheaper flights. Maybe we should start playing that ad again.
Yeah.
But anyway, incredible. I presume there isn't a photograph of Neddy, is there?
Oh, yeah. Brian will fill you in on that.
Oh, yeah. Are there photographs of Neddy, Brian, the child who survived?
There's a couple of newspaper articles that was done. There was one done in 1976, I think, when he was 88, and then another small one when he passed away in 1980.
So the story is still told. Okay, listen. I'm baffled by that ad. Let's listen to that relatively recent ad about rabies.
I remember
from the Irish government.
Rabies kills agonisingly. How do we prevent it reaching Ireland? When going abroad, leave family pets with friends. Alert customs if you suspect an animal is being smuggled in or coming ashore illegally. Vigilance can keep rabies out of Ireland.
There you are. Well, hopefully people are vigilant and just be people always are, I think, always are careful of wild dogs. But anyway, thanks, Alison. Well done on the research, Alison. Alison Maloney and Brian Marr. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Talking last week about, obviously, organ donation, and then we moved on to the whole... idea, a very generous idea of your body going for medical research. And unfortunately, Mike Hannon. Mike, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Joel.
Yeah, and first of all, condolences, because you're recently bereaved.
Just over 2 weeks ago, I lost my wife, Anne. passed away in the Northwest Hospice in Sligo.
Okay.
She had been ill for a while, but anyway, she always wanted to donate her body to medical research. Okay. And so in recent years, she made the decision to sort of do it with the RCSI.
Mm-hmm.
So on the two days before she passed, we spoke, the hospice doctor spoke with Corrigan and son, who you've spoken about before, Joe, and confirmed arrangements to have her body taken to the RCSI. She was close to death at this stage.
Okay.
So I was very happy. I was sort of helping her, I suppose, in a way, ease her into the next life. And I was reassured in the knowledge that her wish was going to be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Following day, she was progressively getting worse. And the following day, contacted Corrigan's again, who contacted the RCSI just to confirm arrangements, to be told that they couldn't take her body. They had a full complement. They were booked her, Joe. That was disappointing to me, but it also presented me with a challenge that at the very last minute I had to make some arrangements for her funeral, etc. And doing that while she was passing was certainly a challenge in a big way. But I was fortunate, very, very fortunate, that I'm from Sligo and live there. We have an undertaker in the county who has an in-house crematorium, McGowan's. I remember I rang McGowan's just to say that I needed to make the sudden change. And the wonderful, she's an angel, Bridge McGowan, David's daughter, said, "Look, Mike, when Anne passes tomorrow morning, I'll take care of her. I'll take her from you. I'll take care of her. And then I'll arrange her cremation whenever you wish that to happen, give you a chance to grieve, etc." So, I suppose my reason for the call, Joe, was one, to alert donors that it can happen, that the body may not be accepted, and to always have a plan B in place.
Your wife, as you said to us in your community, she wanted to be a silent teacher, which is a lovely way of putting it. Do you feel disappointed that the timing didn't work out?
At the time, Joe, I felt disappointed because I felt that her major wish wasn't being fulfilled. So certainly that was a disappointment. I have to say, and this was the reason for my call, but my experience subsequently with the cremation and what was arranged for her reassured me. So in a sense, my trauma and despair turned to almost joy when I basically had, it was the approach that was taken in taking her body and looking after it and handing it back to me. But so my recent call was one, to alert donors that potentially the body may not accept it and to have that plan B. Secondly, I did make a few quick calls to UCD and to Galway, just to see would they be prepared to take her body. Of course, they wouldn't be. But it did strike me that it would not be a bad idea at all if the medical schools had some type of reciprocal arrangement, that in the event of the wound being full, because I assume the same rules would apply to
the
donation processes.
In the world we live in, that it would be fairly easy to set up a database, wouldn't it?
I would have thought so, yeah. I would have thought so. But such life. But, I'm obviously missing Anne. We were together for 45 years. We didn't have any children. So I think when you don't have children, you have a particular relationship. Mm-hmm. And life without her, I'm getting used to it. But it has been a bit of a challenge.
Of course it is. It's early days, yes, after 45. And where did you originally meet, Mike? Where did you meet Anne?
We met in what was the mecca of Irish dancing back in the late 70s. We met in the Irish club in Parnell Square. Parnell Square is where it all happened, between there and
the Iron. The laneway behind, I think that became the apartment. That was in, they moved into nightclubs and...
Sometimes we ventured across to the television club.
That was a big journey, Mike.
Across the river.
And where was Anne from?
Anne was from Offaly. It's called Dang in County Offaly.
And where were you from?
Sligo.
It was a mixed marriage.
It was very much a mixed marriage. And it was very much, I'll say, a country marriage. Anne worked in the old Richmond Hospital. She worked in medical records there, which is why she had this real interest in matters medical. I was working with Coca-Cola in Drogheda at the time. So anyway...
I was up, and I'm sure you do go to Parnell Square. It has obviously the Gay Theatre and Cassidy's Hotel, and of course the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Hugh Lane Gallery and Chapter One, and a few beautiful churches, and Mr. Fox and the INTO and the ICTU. But when I was there last week. I was going into the Hugh Lane Gallery, and there's I don't know whether you've seen it, but it's kind of the only memory of the fact that Parnell Square, as you say, was the mecca of Irish, where people danced to show bands and various other things. And there's a beautiful memorial outside, just beside the National Gallery. And I think it's now, I don't remember, but I think it's on the site of the location in front of where one of the ballrooms used to be. And it's a beautiful, and I always stop at it, and I see people stopping and blessing themselves. And it's a memorial to the Miami Show Band Massacre, which happened, the anniversary is coming up, actually. 1970, the 50th anniversary is coming up. Very, very soon, and that was three band members were murdered, as you know, and it was just horrific, beyond horror. But is it a beautiful, memorial? It's in the shape of a guitar case, studded guitar case, obviously musical notation, and then the names are engraved of the three lads that were.
I'm actually in Dublin today. In fact, as I speak to you, I'm sitting in the middle of St. Stephen's Green on a beautiful balmy afternoon, and I'm going to see Kevin Barry's The Cave at the Abbey this evening.
Oh, yeah, with Tommy Tiernan.
With Tommy Tiernan, yeah. I was born under the caves of Keech in South Sligo, which is what inspired Kevin Barry's... It has a particular relevance. Yeah,
something important
about that.
A great writer, an absolutely great writer. Yeah,
tremendous.
Okay. Enjoy the play. It's got good reviews overall. And anything that Kevin Barry. Now, Kevin Barry, he's a brilliant read. He can confront you with some difficult home truths. So. That's what drama is. What drama is all about.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's your challenge, yeah. It's your challenge.
Okay. Thanks indeed, Mike.